If I was you, I'd be asking for a refund. Everything they do for DOC, they need to defund. Lazy guards, double cells, everything in here is hell. You ever been to the county jail, praying that you get some mail? Then you hit receiving all the stories, can't believe them. I thank God that I'm alive, I thank God that I'm still breathing. After COVID, wearing masks, everyone's sad. How did a virus know a budget? It really makes me laugh. We had good times, bad times, but still it made us strong. It was hard to be accountable, I had to right my wrongs. But now I'm long and forgotten, they forgot about me.
Welcome to another compelling episode of the Defund DOC Podcast, your number one community to hear true prison stories, conniving prison politics, and radical prison reform solutions that will end recidivist crime in America once and for all. Please welcome the hosts, Daniel and Linda Sims, as they dive into another hard-hitting and thought-provoking episode.
Welcome to the Defund DOC Podcast. I'm Linda, and with me is my co-host, Daniel J. Sims.
Hello, everyone in the community and family out there. We got an amazing episode ahead. Got my good friend, Arian. He's an amazing person. This guy, not only is he a former elected prosecutor for Okanagan County, this man also owns his own law firm, Noma Law Firm, and is an adjunct professor at Gonzaga. This man is a jack of all trades in the legal field. The knowledge this man has is profound. So let me introduce Mr. Arian Noma. Welcome.
Hello, Daniel. How are you this evening? Hi, Linda. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
We're great. This is a great episode. Major things that's happening right now is that you're representing me on a clemency petition. So that's one piece of what you're doing. I mean, there's so much. So I'm just going to let you introduce yourself. So give us a brief understanding of yourself.
Well, I was born in Washington State, actually, in Columbia City, the south end of Seattle. And grew up in, I wouldn't say poverty, but definitely not wealth either. So lower middle class to poverty, person of color. So I had that lived experience as well. And then first one in my family to go to college. So I don't come from a long line of lawyers. And I don't want to say I come from a long line of criminals either. But I just prior to knowing the lawyer side of things, I kind of, you know, I grew up knowing more how, from a non-legal sense, how crime operates. At a very young age, because of poor decisions, I was moved to, my parents had to, we were fortunate enough that they moved me to Maryland, D.C. area. And from there, I was able to get into school, eventually get focused. And then my first job out of college was actually I was a school teacher, third and fourth grade. Taught all subjects in Southeast D.C. And then I went to law school. I didn't go to law school for power. I didn't go to law school for money. I literally went to law school to try to help my community. So after law school, pretty much spent my entire career, for the most part. I mean, we do civil work, too, at my law firm, but the majority focus has been criminal prosecution or defense for most of my career, which has now spanned about 20 years in Maryland, Washington, D.C., and here in Washington State. And I've done everything from petty theft trials to murder trials, everything in between, all the way to appeals and personal restraint petitions as well.
Wow. So you were on both sides. I mean, not especially inside of the criminal side of it, but growing up low income and growing in those communities where the peer pressure is more towards falling into the traps of drug dealing, gang culture, whatnot, and you were able to extricate yourself out of that. That's commendable, because you said South Seattle. I'm actually from North Seattle, so I know you were in quite a neighborhood.
At that time period, I mean, I was born many moons ago in 1976, so I had the fortunateness or unfortunateness, depending upon how you look at it, of, you know, I grew up in the crack era in Columbia City, so it definitely wasn't like it is today. It was a lot rougher.
100%, yeah.
But I think getting out, yes, I mean, there's work that I put in for sure. And there were choices that I made as I got older that were mature decisions and probably prudent. But even to get to the point to make those decisions, there's a lot of blessing involved by the Lord and a lot of luck. Because, you know, at any point, you know how it is when you're in those kind of environments, your trajectory, you know, you can just take one push and you're off that cliff of no return, and that's it. It's over.
Absolutely.
like I remember, you know, being younger, under 21, I was caught with a firearm. You know, that's not legal, right? You're not 21. If I didn't have the privilege of having a college ID at the time in my wallet, when the police are, you know, they're getting ready to book me, they're going through all my inventory. Well, one of the cops saw a college ID from Philadelphia, because I was going to St. Joseph's University at the time. And he was like, you realize when we book you, your life's over on this firearm. He's like, you realize that, right? Like, there's no more college for you. So he, for whatever reason, you know, and I'm not a fan of cops by any means, as we get into this, you know, I'm sure that'll be evident. But I had an angel that day. That cop, for whatever reason, felt some type of way and he saw that college ID, and it caused him to pause for a moment and think of an alternative. And I didn't get booked that night.
Wow.
Right. And had I been booked by that cop, he's right. My life, I mean, I didn't understand at the time. I didn't go to law school, but, you know, a firearm for, you know, unlawful possession, second degree, even, that's it. It's over. You got a class C felony and you're out of the game.
Wow. Yeah. That was a blessing right from above, for sure.
I had an angel cop, man. I have to admit that, you know, I be fair. I had an angel cop.
Wow. That's compelling, man. That's a genuine, you know, that you look back on those little moments, and that's one of them, huh? That you're like, wow, it could have gone either way.
I'll never forget, because he was a veteran. That cop was a veteran. I remember being in the back of the car speaking with him while the rookie was searching the car. And when the rookie found the gun, I could see it. The rookie was like, I got a good bust. Like, this is game on.
Oh, no.
And the veteran was like, he literally said to me, this was a veteran cop. He literally was like, what the fuck am I supposed to do with that? That's a gun. You know, and I told him, like, look, I have no excuse. And, you know, I was too stupid to use the Fifth Amendment and remain silent. So I'm like, I have no excuse, which now puts me in possession of it. And I was like, do what you have to do. I get it. You got to do your job. And he worked it out with his sergeant to where they didn't book. But had he not been a veteran, had he not had some kind of compassion and empathy, my life would have been totally different.
Man, I wonder if he could ever see him again, you know what I mean? Like, to show him what actual alternatives is mass incarceration can produce, you know what I mean?
I actually tried to invite him when I transferred from St. Joseph's University to the University of Washington and eventually was graduating. I did try to. I went down to the precinct. My mom made me and invited him to the graduation. He had retired, though. So he never came. But, you know, in spirit, I mean, I think, you know, I do credit him because, it totally could have went a different way.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. That's amazing. Because, I mean, even in my journey, the two crimes I'm in prison for related to guns and that lifestyle of, you know, immaturity and just gang culture and drug culture and whatnot. And it's just so easy to fall into that. Like, everyone around you that you're like, that are cool and, you know, whatnot around you, that's fully acceptable and like commonplace. And it's such a trap, man, such a trap. So I'm just really happy that you were able to get blessed like that, you know?
Can you share what drives you to help individuals like Daniel through the way to justice?
Yeah, for me, it comes naturally because of, like, the stories that I'm sharing with you from my childhood. I literally, when I represent a client, whether it's on clemency or a trial in a criminal case, I literally see myself. Unfortunately, most lawyers don't have lived experience with the system, and therefore they're kind of on the outside looking in. They don't have the it's harder to have empathy, or even I can literally sympathize with people because I've been there. I've worn that jumper. So I've always wanted to give back in that respect. Also, to touch on what Daniel's talking about, you know, the traps of some of our communities, being an understanding American history with context. I feel like if you actually understand American history with context, there you'll know that those traps are there by design. They're on purpose. As Donald Trump and his party would say, you know, things are rigged. They literally are rigged to create a second-class citizen in the form of a prisoner for labor. And we know that because if you look prior to 1868, when you get the 14th Amendment, and prior to 1868, slavery's legal, you don't have a large prison population in America. You just don't, because you have slaves to work for free. And you don't get a prison population until after 1965, in around 1968, in the war on drugs. the war on drugs was created in order to get a large prison population so that you have labor. And that's why you're in the, I mean, it's the Generation Xers. Daniel, are you born in the 70s, early 80s?
Yeah, early 80s.
So you might still be an Xer or you're a millennial, but it's the baby boomers, which is my dad's generation. They weren't incarcerated at the rate of Generation X. It's Generation X that is the prison industrial complex. It's my age that, and that's important because that's an entire generation of fathers and mothers that didn't get to raise their children.
Wow.
Those children are now committing crimes, and society's saying, and society's blaming the parents and those kids, but the parents weren't there. The parents were incarcerated. They didn't have a choice.
Yes.
So that's part of how the system's rigged, and it just keeps going. So we have to, I feel like there's got to be some people that are there like me to be the sand in the gears, you know, to slow the grind down.
Absolutely.
And that's why I do the work that I do. Is one, any prisoner is me. But two, the system itself is just, it's always been rigged and it's wrong.
Absolutely. I mean, you're literally on the front line fighting. This is a war for our people, for the soul of this country almost, you know, the what you're doing and like what others like.
Not even almost, literally.
The
most vulnerable
literally.
Populations in any society, American society, German society, wherever, Africa, the most vulnerable population is the population that you can tell the health of every other population in that society from that vulnerable population.
Wow.
And if societies are cruel to the vulnerable, then it usually reflects how cruel that society is to everybody else.
Yeah, I would add to that. I think that you're 100% right. Like the sentences, when you're killing somebody with slow sentences, when they haven't killed somebody to deserve such a sentence, whether it's with drugs, drug crimes, whether it's with any crime, when you're putting them away for 30, 40 years and they haven't killed, you know there's an ulterior motive. You know what I mean? And we both know, and you just touched on it, labor is subsidizing this. So It's like breathing a breath of fresh air, hearing somebody of your caliber, your knowledge, your experience, saying that what the audience and I have, we've been saying this, and this is a real thing that's happening. People just are, they just not knowledgeable about it, 13th Amendment and all the implications with that.
No, we're programmed early to, to trust your government, trust your system, you know, and most people, you know, who don't have any contact or family member who have had contact with the criminal system, I think they just automatically assume that there's nothing nefarious or evil about it. It's there and it works. But if you look at the Sentencing Reform Act itself, Sentencing Reform Act of 1981, just in the beginning, it tells you the purposes of the act. And the number one purpose, I would be okay if it even just said punishment or rehabilitative punishment, because that would make sense. You did a crime, you get punished, and in your punishment, it's rehabilitative, though. We're trying to fix you. That seems to make sense, because then if we fix you, then you get released, you don't commit any other crimes, and society's better, right?
Yeah.
Well, the Sentencing Reform Act, if you look at it, I'm pretty sure, double check this, but I'm 99% sure, you could Google it right now, it said it's retributive punishment. Retributive. Retribution.
Wow.
That's revenge.
Yeah.
That's revenge. Whether you're religious or not, religious books have spoken, prophets in every culture have spoken about. The Christian Bible itself says wrath, which is revenge, is the Lord's. That's not yours. It's Him.
100%.
Take no place in wrath, for vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. But our society in Washington, our legislatures have decided, for whatever reason, that they're smarter than God, because they've chosen to put in place retributive punishment. It's retribution for what you've done. Well, that's designed to break you. That's revenge. That's not designed with any
pure
qualities involved.
It works. I'm broken. And you're right. Most of the men in here, they're broken, man. And it's done that. And I feel like, and you could probably speak more on it, but the government should be in the place of, like, they have a Latin word for a parent. The government should be like a parent or whatnot, and try to help you and rehabilitate you and make you a better person, as opposed to crush you like they're doing, stealing your labor. You know what I mean? And exploiting you. And it's like, how did they, like you said, how did you even come to agree to a retributive system like that, you know?
We know that it happened in 1981, looking
Norman
at history.
Norman Ealing was the sponsor of it. I know that for sure. Right, he was pushing the sentencing reform.
And looking at history and context, the crack era is coming. 1981, cocaine is becoming big. And so there's probably a spike in crime if we go back and look at that time in Washington. And they didn't know what to do, so politicians sold, hey, we'll just be tough on crime, which the voter liked. And then once the voter liked that, then you get elected and you're going to keep that system going, because it becomes a system where if you're the prosecutor and you become irreplaceable, if you're in a system where it's retributive and you have to be there. I guess what I'm trying to say is when I prosecuted, I always looked at it like, if we could fix every one of these people I'm prosecuting and they don't commit crimes anymore, wouldn't society be safer? Like, so shouldn't my job really be to prosecute my way out of a job?
Exactly.
Like, the ultimate dream goal, shouldn't it be that I don't have a job anymore? Well, I've found in my 20 years of practicing in Maryland, D.C., and here, that's not the attitude of prosecutors. They want more criminals, and they want more crime so they can have more criminals, because that justifies their existence.
Oh,
and it justifies their
beautiful
power.
It's working. Amazingly beautiful. Trust me. 87% recidivism. And they keep people as, I hate using the proper terminology, but they just keep us as stupid as they can. There's rarely any real meaningful education in here. They keep us in poverty, keep us saddled with debt. Then they charge us all kind of exorbitant fees to our family to keep our families in poverty, and then steal our labor. So you don't get any release with any kind of funds or nothing. So it's the sick cycle that you're speaking on.
Yeah, and I don't think people realize that when you talk about your jobs or work inside of there, they don't realize that in Washington they call that a gratuity. And the reason they call it a gratuity is so you don't have to be covered by labor and industries. And so part of, you know, the money that they take out is all profit. It's not going to Social Security. It's not going to for you later. It's not going to labor and industries if you were injured on the job to get workers' compensation, you know. And so it's interesting because they tell you that you have to work. You correct me if I'm wrong, but you have to work to get good time credits, correct?
I think they're starting to change that bill, but yeah, that's 100% right. You'll get a major infraction for failure to program. And it's even more insidious than that, Aaron. And they have a thing called correctional industries, which is like this opaque, secretive, like private entity that's separate from DOC, that is like enslaving all these people and making them work to create office equipment, food factory, Meals on Wheels, all these little other things where they're making mass millions of profit and paying everybody a dollar.
I think that's important to highlight, because I don't think people realize, you know, they like to program Meals on Wheels that feeds people in poverty. I don't think they have any idea that it's you prisoners that are feeding the poor. It's the people in poverty that are actually feeding the people in poverty. That's still not rich people doing that. And I think that needs to be highlighted. That's a big deal.
Yeah, for sure. And they actually, at the University of Washington, I don't know what year this was, but DOC, Correctional Industry, supplied the dorm houses over there at the University of Washington and some office buildings with office equipment and bedding and whatnot. And the students found out about it, and they went on a strike. They found out it was prisoner slave labor that used to make that stuff. So when people find out, like, hey, people are compelled by force to create these things. You know what I mean? They're using coercion. It's a different type of force, but it's still force. It's coercion, you know, and it's very insidious. And then you're right. People do need to know about it.
For the prisoner themselves, if you're not rehabilitating in any way, you don't have programs, you're really just putting that person on a timeout. You're not
warehouse.
When they get out, they're not going to have any choice but to eventually fall back into that. Number two, you are literally murdering future generations. You're destroying any chance for kids.
The innocent victim.
We have enough data that children who have one parent that's incarcerated for most of their life, they have the same post-traumatic stress as a person from war, like in Iraq war. They have the same level of post-traumatic stress and trauma. So traumatizing those by, you know, punishing the children for the sins of their father, it's two birds with one stone. And then so when that kid grows up and then falls into the same drug trap and does the same thing that their parent did, then we blame them and say that it's your ethnicity or your race or your economic class or whatever reason, when it's actually part of the system itself. I think it's useless and futile, because why would, knowing that you're part of it, you can't escape responsibility and then say, well, that's on you for making those poor decisions when you're actually, you know, there is a role that DOC plays in creating future criminals.
Absolutely. I think it's on par with human rights violations, honestly. I mean, you're perpetuating a cycle upon a people that are most times the most, as you said earlier, disadvantaged of that population. So it's almost like a form of genocide to that people. You know, they're mostly all in poverty, mostly traumatized childhood traumas, and it's just vicious. It's not like it's a fair system where everybody gets the same shot at justice, and then you go to a place where you're actually being reformed and rehabilitated. It's just cruel. I mean, you're literally, as you said, you're on a timeout with idleness and no programming, nothing, and set on this track. And the whole time your child is out there, how to fend for themselves, not being taught the proper direction and going down the wrong road. And that's called intergenerational incarceration. And it's vicious, and it's happening across the country.
What ideas and solutions do you feel would combat crime and recidivism without using the current practice of long prison sentences?
Well, it's funny. That's a great question. I actually, when I ran for prosecutor, I think I campaigned on some of these issues. I campaigned on prosecutorial reform. I believe the system needs to be, if not reformed, then the only other choice is to dismantle it. I don't think it needs to actually be dismantled if we truly reform it. So one thing I think we could do is all low level, and our legislature in Washington thankfully has done some of this work already. We were one of the few states where drug possession was still a felony. Just by making that a gross misdemeanor, you've saved a lot of lives. I would go one step further and do more diversion programs for low-level crimes and people who are addicts. I would have diversion programs. Let's say it's a theft case, right? Just simple theft case. Person keeps stealing. First, I would try to identify, why are you stealing? Sometimes, you know, because you always get the extreme arguments that when you bring reform up. Sometimes people are kleptomaniacs. They just steal. They like stealing. In my experience, most people steal because they're hungry and they can't afford what it is they're stealing.
Yeah.
So if I train you and give you a job where you can afford that, probably won't steal anymore.
Yeah, 100%.
Like, dare to just put faith in people. Right. So same thing with drugs. Most people who are suffering from drug addiction also suffer, whether they realize it or not. They usually don't realize it till they get substantive good treatment. They usually are suffering from what's called dual diagnosis. They also have mental health issues. And when you're treating mental health issues and symptoms with drugs, that's not the root cause. The drug addiction is not the root cause of the problem. The problem is the mental health problem, right? So once again, if we get to the root of the problem and we solve the mental health issues, they'll probably be more apt to not use drugs. I'm not saying that they won't right away, but you're on a better path to getting them to actually recover. And you could do this with most crimes other than the violent ones, the class A's and the violent sex offenses. And that would immediately reduce your prison population. You reinvest those funds in programs that work, trainings and education that works, and then the prison population gets lower and society benefits and gets better. Another example, during the pretrial process for the last 20 years in Chicago, Illinois, if you're charged with any kind of domestic violence offense, you get a nurse that comes to your house once a week to check in on your family. That nurse is cheaper than the police officer, and they've noticed that pending trial, DV drops about 99%. Why? The nurse is a mandatory reporter. Right. And the nurse is more apt to be let in the home to do the investigation. One, because it's court ordered, but two, it's not a cop. The family's more comfortable with the nurse, and the nurse is actually more trained to deal with those kind of health issues than the cop. Right. The cop just knows how to respond to the traumatic event, but not how to treat the problems. And so what you're doing when you're that pretrial period, when you drop DV 99%, is not only are you helping that family in the immediacy, but if that family has kids, guess what you're doing? You're reprogramming that child so that child knows that DV is wrong, and now you've eliminated a future abuser, because that's where domestic violence is learned, in your home, just like racism's learned in your home. No one's born racist. You get taught that. So no one's born to beat their spouse. You get taught that, right? And they've noticed that they've had that program 20 years. They've noticed it has affected their numbers of active DV cases now, because those kids grew up and they know DV is wrong.
It just seems like a common sense thing that legislators should know is, like, let's keep them in the home. Let's put some resources in their pathway, help them rehabilitate in their community so that they can stay in that community and become rehabilitated and, you know, contributing members of society. Why is that a fringe thought, though? You know what I mean? Like, you must be a radical for even proposing something like that.
Yeah, it seems odd because it is common sense. It seems like common sense. These things can work. I mean, it just seems historically our prison system, not just Washington, but nationwide, has been retributive. It's been designed to round up certain populations and keep them in the caste system. Remember, I don't think a lot of people know this, but you can go to the Law Enforcement Memorial Fund, the Law Enforcement Memorial Fund. That's run by cops. And it'll say right there, the first cops were in North Carolina and they were slave patrols. See, America Wow. didn't have cops in cities 300 years ago like we have today. There were no, right, when white men were free and could own property and their spouses were chattel and their slaves were chattel, there was no need for a cop. It wasn't until those slaves wanted to be free and they left those plantations that cops came into existence.
Wow.
Right? So that culture, the cop culture, comes from slave patrols. In the root of their training to this day, it's catching people. And at the root of that is slave patrol. So they can't divorce themselves from that. It was founded on something pretty sick. So it goes hand in hand. And I think that that's part of the reason our system ballooned into what it ballooned into. It really was designed to be a warehousing system for the people that we discount and don't really want in our society.
Yeah, it's sickening. I mean, if you think about it, the way you just articulated it, it's pretty profound because it's continuation of slave patrol. I mean, they're using the same tactics to catch people, and then they're enslaving them.
We always said growing up in my neighborhood, you know, the cars always say, like, protecting the community, community safety. We always said patrol and control. That's what they do. Patrol and control. Like, we are uneducated street kids, and we knew that.
Yeah, and it's not like the landowners back in the day, right? They weren't trying to control them at any point, but the current status quo is to control the working class, the poor class, and the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
The elite, they don't need the police. That's why the police are not patrolling those rich neighborhoods like they do in South Seattle or North Seattle and parts of it and all the different, you know, low-income neighborhoods. That's where they over-police. And then they're like, oh, yeah, because there's lots of crime there. Yeah, well, why aren't you addressing root causes? Redlining and
right.
lack of, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, there is a lot of systemic things that are tied into all that. And
why do the smoking rates, the cancer rate, not just crime, but all, like, societal ills and negative aspects like higher rates of cancer, higher rates of smoking. South of Chinatown, what they call International District today, it's all higher. In the north end of Seattle, it's all lower. Well, look at the populations. It's a segregated city.
Yeah.
It's a very segregated city.
Liquor stores on every corner in South Seattle. Yeah, for sure. I know exactly what you're saying.
Oh, the liquor stores, that's nationwide. Liquor store, gun store, Foot Locker. That's how they keep us in. For those that are asleep, that's how you easily get moved into the game, is that's all you know and that's all you see. You right? I'm drunk, I got a gun, and I want those shoes.
Materialism, yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's sad. It's definitely something that needs to be spoken about more. It's like, why are they investing so heavily on these substances and these tools of murder and materialism and all the big movements out there in regards to music and whatnot? They're always like talking about materialism and all these things that can drag down a people, and they're glamorizing it. But yet, who's funding these record companies? You know what I mean? Like, it's not the communities that they're trying to galvanize. It's actually rich people, these elites, sitting in these ivory towers like, oh, do you think the masses will love this music right now? Oh, let's drop it then.
And why, you touching on like a certain type of music, it's easy to look up. Most record companies are heavily invested in private prison because we buy and sell prisons on our stock market. CCA is a good, CoreCivic. These are private prison industries. Well, Jive RCA Records, Virgin Atlantic, go look it up. They're all invested in the private prison.
Are you serious? Wow.
All of them. So I get, right, I get money from the artists that I put out there to promote, you know, shooting up the club and living that rah-rah lifestyle. And then when you go shoot up the club and live that rah-rah lifestyle, I get profit in the form of shares. I get dividends at the end of the year because you got locked up.
That's so crazy. I know. And it's a real thing. I mean, you literally can glamorize.
I grew up with hip-hop. I don't even listen to it anymore because of that.
Yeah, me too. I loved rap music. I love hip-hop. I love, you know, that, like you said, that rah-rah lifestyle. And I got sucked into it as well. And now I rarely listen to music at all. I listen to podcasts mostly. But it's so crazy that you say it like that because that's real. It's real because they are the ones that are shaping public opinion. They are the ones that are propagating these ideas, right? They got the millions to put the distribution out there, right? They got the millions to put it onto all the TV stations and make it mainstream and whatnot. Who's doing that? Why are they profiting from, you know, people talking about killing people? You know what I'm saying? Like, what is the
why would you even
agenda?
Want to?
Yeah, what is the agenda?
Like, even if there was billions of dollars there, why would you want to?
Exactly.
You know, like Jesus said, you can serve God or you can serve money. You can't serve two masters. You can't serve both. Pick one.
Absolutely.
So even if you saw like mass profit and this is an easy way to profit and that's great, you're on the wrong path already. You've already lost.
And people got to realize that propaganda, it can be in music, it can be in TV, news, everything. And they want to keep people in the...
Yeah, and it's not just in Russia. I'm tired of Americans, like, they can point out German propaganda or Russian propaganda, but they, for whatever reason, this country is not programming you. It's absolutely programming you. Why do you think 100%. We're all racist? Because we're the most racist country on the planet. It's part of our programming.
It's sickening, man. It's a us versus them society when we should be one people. You know what I mean? That's one thing that we are really about on Defund DOC. It's like, it's not about race. It's not about nothing. It's about one people, one citizen, one American, and what we're doing to our country. You know what I mean? To our people. So, yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out. It's very insidious.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's, I don't know how it got, you know, we're young. So these systems were in place. I think the DOC is as old as 1881. I think that's when DOC started.
No, DOC in Washington State was enacted in 1981.
No, I think it's 1881.
No, I actually did the research for it.
Oh, is it 19?
Yeah, it used to be DSHS before 1981.
Oh,
yeah, it's crazy. But the system was here, though, Arian. It was here before that. They had the prisons all here before that. But it's crazy, man. It's crazy.
Can you share how others can become civically engaged and help those on the front line, like yourself, to obtain change and reform?
Well, you know, I could easily say, like, everybody become a lawyer and get in this fight. But that is probably not feasible. The simple answer to that is, anybody who wants to get involved with this, all you have to do is care. Number one, just care about something other than yourself, and then go feed someone. Go wash someone's feet. Go the simple things that are laughed at in the Bible, like literally go do those things. That's all it takes to change someone's life. You don't have to meet them in the system. What if you meet them before they even fall in the system? And it's your compassion and your sympathy and your help that changes the trajectory. Then they never even went to the system. It's too late once someone falls in the system. Once you need me, once you know me, I used to tell that to clients all the time. I'm a criminal defense attorney. You shouldn't even know me. Once you know me, there's a problem in your life. You don't want to know me. So what we need to do is, as Daniel pointed out, get away from materialism. Start literally, don't hate the word communism, commune, community. Don't hate that word. They teach you and program you to hate here. Community should matter to you. If your brother or your sister is not doing as well as you, that should bother you. And so with that mindset and that frame of mind where you're constantly being selfless and you're helping others, then you just take that information and your lived experience, just stay active with your legislature. Know what laws they're trying to pass. And comment on them, because this state allows you to comment. Anybody can comment. Don't pass this law. This is why. I get out there every day with the homeless and I feed them. They're not bad people. Don't criminalize them, because that's, you know, one of the things that is about to happen. They're going to criminalize homelessness. It's going to be illegal to be homeless.
That's crazy.
Right? And so that's going to be a whole new prison population for just not having a home. Well, tell your legislature that doesn't make sense.
they make it impossible to maintain a home these days.
Right. That so you're going to make criminals and then give them free homes that are paid for by taxpayers so that somebody can have a job? Doesn't help anybody. So I think those are the main things, is just be a good person. And we as our society just teaches us to be way too selfish, way too self-centered. I mean, look at my profession. Daniel, I don't know how many lawyers you've had, but most of them suck. And that's because most of them are fucking selfish. And they're lying to you the whole time. That's all they care about is themselves. And they're lying to themselves. They tell themselves in the mirror that they care about Daniel, but they don't. They don't. How many of your lawyers check up on you? None. Right, because they don't care. All they cared about is the paycheck. When you're making money off people, that's bad. That's a slaver.
And it's miserable. I mean, like, this is the worst of existence. I mean, literally every morning, Arian, I wake up and I'm miserable. And I have purpose. You know, I have a beautiful wife. I have a podcast and I wrote books and I've done these things. But yet I'm stuck in this one, you know, environment where violence is, I'm surrounded by violence. I'm surrounded by prejudice and guard brutality and oppression, like just stifling me every day as soon as I wake up. And it's just, oh my goodness, man. And yet, you know, nobody cares. Like I have like my wife that I talk to and that's about it, you know? And that's the case for many Americans incarcerated across the country.
Yeah.
It's sad.
I think for most people to help, they just need to be caring. And then after that, just make yourself competent to the issues. Don't argue things or take up causes that you don't fully understand. You got to be competent in those. And then you need to have courage. Like, don't be a coward. There's going to be a lot of people that tell you no.
Yeah. I mean, Arian, you know how much turbulence I faced doing a book called Defund DOC and then a podcast called Defund DOC while in DOC. So you're right. You have to be ready. You have to be confident. But I would add to what you were saying, if there's nothing else that you feel like, but you want to be a part of the movement, you can write to somebody in prison. You know, you could start being their advocate. You know, my wife has to advocate for me all the time, and that's invaluable. You know, her being able to contact the superintendent. I can't talk to the superintendent and I'm inside his prison, but my wife can literally call him, you know what I mean, and send him an email anytime she wants.
You can't go sign the substance abuse authorization that I need you to sign and they keep sending it to me to send to you and I'm like, he's right there.
It's like there's a disconnect. Like, I'm not even a human, I'm just a subhuman that's on their plantation.
And there's a lot of truth to that, unfortunately. I mean, that's literally how they're trained,
the prejudice. Mm-hmm. That's why I said that, deal with that prejudice, man. You speak to people, you know, and that's one thing I would like to say for you, man. Thank you. From the very moment I've talked to you, I've never, not one time, ever detected any prejudice or any kind of, you know, stigma, anything. You know, people think, oh, you're in prison, you're a bad person. I'm a good person. Like, I have nothing but love and compassion for people, and I want to help people. But people don't know that because, you know, they just see me as a prisoner, you know?
No, they put that branded badge on you, and they want to identify you by that. And it's not even, the identification isn't even necessarily an accurate identification. It's their perception of what a prisoner is. So if that's a negative identification, no matter what you've done, you can't overcome that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I know guys who have done, I know a guy who did 25 years and today he's a lawyer.
Yeah, you were telling me
right?
about that.
But there's other people that will still look at him and be like, he's a piece of shit inmate.
Wow, that's so like, crazy.
That'll be his whole life. You know, he's going to have to deal with that to some degree. You know, being a lawyer, he'll get further and further from that with time. You know, there may come a day 20 years from now where no one remembers, they're all dead. But there's still a lot of people in the community that he practices in that knows where he came from. And they judge him.
Wow.
You know, and they judge his legal abilities based on the fact that he was a prisoner, as if they're related when they're not necessarily related. Or in some places they might intersect, but they're not totally related. I know guys who left, became barbers, and you know they're doing well, but there's still those people on both sides of the fence, either formerly incarcerated people that they've been in with that know them, or you know, ex-police that are like, I remember when you know you were this way. They still judge. And these guys have been barbers now for 15 years, you know, like that's all I do is barber. I'm not doing anything but cutting hair.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a true fact, that the stigma is just so vicious. It's as you were speaking on earlier, it's a throwback from the slave system. It's actually a thing called slave papers that used to attach to slaves, and now it's the same thing with the criminal justice system today.
It's all it is making a certain type of citizen so that they have a little bit less rights, and that's what this is always on a national level, you know, separating apart the immigration, anti-immigration movement. That's what that is all really about, is another form of creating a second-class citizen. That's why they're trying to argue no birthright citizenship. It's all tied together.
I agree with you 100%. I don't understand trying to dilute the American birthright. That's plainly written in the 14th Amendment, but I just don't find that credible that they can find a way to circumvent birthright citizenship. I mean,
it's actually not new. We actually went through this in 1987. It's called the Robert Bork Confirmation Hearings. Robert Bork was running for Supreme Court Justice to take Justice Powell's position. He resigned early, and Reagan was president. Robert Bork, he didn't believe that everybody was a citizen. He was the first one to make this birthright citizenship argument. He also was anti-abortion. Okay, if you just from 1987 to now, that's the same political views that have just taken over. And what's important to understand about how immigration and the birthright citizenship affects the real actual American-born citizen, the reason they're doing that is if you can redefine what a citizen is, then you don't have to give them due process. That's why you keep hearing due process on the news right now. Due process is your trial. That's your right to a fair trial. And if you notice, some illegals are not getting trials, right? They're getting removed without even having a trial. All this ties back to labor, though. You didn't have this problem in 1776 because you had a slave. The slave was considered property. The slave couldn't sue, right? That's why that decision is so important, and no one remembers it in history. Is Dred Scott was a slave that said, hey, look, I'm being abused, I'm being assaulted. And they said, you can't sue because you're not a human, you're a chattel. And so chattel can't sue its owner. You don't see chairs suing their owner. If an owner wants to break up a chair and put it in the fire, they can do that. They own the chair, right? And so when 1868 came and the Civil War ended, we enacted the 14th Amendment, which said all people born here are now citizens and they get equal protection of the laws and they get due process. That was literally made for slaves, literally. Because to correct Dred Scott. Well, what did the white American, what did they do in the 1890s? They imported the first wave of immigrants called the Chinese to build the railroads and the Irish to build the railroads. That's your first immigration. You don't have immigration when slavery's legal. You don't get immigration until slavery's illegal because you need free, cheap labor. And we got them from China. We called them coolies. And we didn't pay them and we murdered them. And we have these cases called the Chinese exclusion cases where we told them, you can come here and work, but you cannot become a citizen. You have to go home. So they had their period and their turn. This is why you have laundry houses and restaurants all over the country that are Chinese. That's why you have that, because that's what they were allowed to do. Just like blacks, they were not allowed to go to college. They were not allowed to become lawyers. They were not allowed to become doctors. They could have a laundry house or they could have a restaurant. And that's today. That's why you have those. And then throughout history, each wave, as these immigrants have come and they've worked their way out of slave labor up to the next economic class, we pick a new wave. And the Latino is since the 1980s. They're the newest. The Latinx population are just the newest wave of immigrants, and they're taking the brunt of it right now because they're also getting kicked out for coming here as immigrants to work. But we invited them here. And I live in Okanagan County currently, which is all the apple orchards. I would argue 75% of the labor is illegal.
Wow.
Okay, so that worker, that owner, is also dependent upon that free labor. He can't afford to pay me $30 an hour to pick apples. Right? He needs that labor too. And so what our country's trying to do, because our country, I think, is broke and can't compete on with China on the global scale, is it's squeezing its citizens. When you run out of money, where you got to look other places. Well, the only place that they can look right now is internally, because nobody's buying Ford. Africa ain't buying Ford right now. China's not buying Ford. Europe's not buying Ford. They're buying electric cars. We're the only ones in the gas, right? We've sold too many iPhones. No one else is buying the iPhone, right? And so where do they get the money? By taking your tax dollars, by taking your labor wages. That's where they get the money. Because like you said, the elite in the ivory tower, he's not going to take less. He's going to take the same profit he always takes. And so that has to come from somewhere, and that's going to come from the poor.
Yeah.
Citizen or not, You have to stand in solidarity. We all have to stand in solidarity with the immigrant because it affects us. The immigrant is ancillary, even though they're the direct attack right now. That's not really what they're trying to get at. What they're trying to get at is destabilize who's a citizen and who isn't.
Yeah, this is what I don't like at all. Today it's the immigrant, but tomorrow it's back to the criminal. And, you know, the American that has made a bad decision, that's a crime under the law. They did it for the whole 80s and 90s. I remember it distinctly of how they would demonize Americans, how they would, like you were speaking on the crap epidemic and using that as a pretext to incarcerate masses of Americans. And today they're doing it to the immigrant, of course, right? But tomorrow they're going to do it to the American people. Once they secure the border and they get however many illegal immigrants out of the country, you know, they're going to turn Fox News back into a, oh, look at all this crime. Look at all the, we need to turn up the penalties for crime. And CNN is guilty of it too. You know what I mean? The Democrats, it's a bipartisan thing that has created this cruel system of long prison sentences. And you said earlier, propaganda is not just in Germany. It's here in America. And
it really is. Like people don't
both
believe it when
guilty.
I tell them that. They're like, no way. And I'm like, no, they're really doing that to you too.
Yeah, 100%. They can turn up, they can shape public opinion. People don't realize. All you got to do 4-to-4 coverage, news coverage of something, and you're going to shape public opinion around that. You know what I mean? And so easy to do. It's like literally all you got to do is, you know, line up a bunch of news stations and radio stations talking about one topic, and before you know it, they've shaped public opinion around that topic.
Is Puffy guilty? Like, he's already,
yeah.
Like, the public already found him guilty. Like, there's no free trial for it. I mean, he's not going to get it.
I said it last night. I said, man, I think that is so messed up what is happening to Puff. I mean, I don't know exactly all the facts about what happened with him, but I know he doesn't deserve a death sentence. You know what I mean? They're talking about giving him a life in prison. I know that he didn't kill nobody, and that's called proportionality theory. You have to be proportionate. You know what I mean? Like, there's no... Unless
proportionate to what? In our system, it's retributive. So how much...
Exactly.
Proportion to how much revenge, though? Like...
Yeah, but I mean,
I need a lot of revenge on this one. Like,
yeah,
this
exactly.
one's important to me. Like, this one's important to me.
I'm agreeing, man. It's like, how much revenge is there? You know, like, should we murder this man, Puffy, in a slow death sentence in a cage for what he did, what he alleged to have done? I don't think so. But, yeah, they're literally sharpening their knives trying to get him in there. I mean, they're, like, it's 4-to-4 coverage of it.
So, yeah, there's been so much coverage on it, and it showed that video. I just don't think anybody in America hasn't seen it. And so...
Yeah.
Like, how do you get on the jury veneer? How do you get on the jury? Like,
yeah, who likes a woman beater? Who likes a sex? What are you, a freak off guy that does freak offs and does? You know what I mean? Like, they've demonized this guy, but yet we've all known him. We all listened to his music. We all grew up with this man. So yeah, it's like R. Kelly's been rotting away in Chicago. You know what I'm saying? He's doing the rest of his life in prison. And to me, it's just not proportionate. You know what I mean? Like, I've seen people in prison that had a 17-year prison sentence for murdering their girlfriend and their unborn baby. So that's a 17-year prison. That's two bodies. How does he get 17 and then you got, you know, these people getting life sentences when there was no murder, you know?
Right, it was a robbery, but like five, there was a gun involved and five people were there, so they gave him five assaults with five gun enhancements.
Well, that's my case.
yeah, and then, of course.
Yeah,
with the,
that's what you're speaking of. You're speaking on my case. That, there was literally...
Yeah, that's 300 months
that's
of consecutive
case.
Time that you can't even touch until, like,
yeah.
That the gun enhancements gotta go. Like, enhancements are crazy.
22 years straight and then 10 years on top of that, so 34 years for my sentence. Nobody was even severely hurt. You know what I mean? You know how hurt I've been in this 20 years of incarceration? Like, I'm not even comparing it to the harm that has happened to the victim, but I have been severely traumatized in this sentence, and is that proportionate? You know what I mean? And
right.
Then my son, my innocent victim, my son, like, he's been without his father for the last 20 years that I've been in prison. So it's like you said, it doesn't seem fair. They stack all these enhancements up. It's just cruel. It's evil.
No, and the weight they put on your son. I mean, if your son ever gets in trouble and says, well, you know, my dad was incarcerated, I didn't have, they're going to be like, son, you're supposed to know better. You know, like it's like,
yeah.
Okay, yeah, I get that. I know I'm supposed to know better, but I maybe
yeah.
didn't in this situation because my dad wasn't here. You know, they'll still use it against him later, but he somehow is expected to know as a kid.
Yeah, it's sickening, man. It's sickening, and I'm grateful there's people like you on the front line, man, because You know, I believe all through the 90s, there was not a lot of people out there, you know, really spoke against this system. It was just, it seemed like every time you looked, there was people just pushing this cruelty and long, hard on crime. I call it dumb on crime because it doesn't work. We know that. So anyways, give us a brief understanding of what you're doing for Juvenile.
Well, one of the things that I do is I work with the Youth Access to Counsel Line, and that's a newer law in Washington. It's RCW 13.40.74. And what that says is anytime a person under the age of 18 is going to be interrogated, interviewed, searched, or arrested by a police officer, the police officers are now required in real time to put that minor on the phone with a licensed lawyer so we can explain their Fourth Amendment right to refuse searches, their Fifth Amendment right to remain silent, and how waiving that right will be used against them, and their Sixth Amendment right to have a lawyer present during questioning for help. The reason that law was put into place, it probably makes total sense to you, but for your listeners who aren't aware, there was no law in place, and the law presume that kids, even 8-year-olds, when a police officer read them their right to remain silent, that they understood that and were making a knowing and intelligent waiver of that right when they were speaking to police. Prior to this law being enacted, I think about 90% of kids talked to the police. Now that this law has been enacted, I think only about 1% actually talked to the police. So I think we're saving a lot of kids and keeping them out of harm's way by teaching them that anything that they tell a police officer, it's going to be used against them. It'll never be used for them.
Yeah, you're saving lives. You're saving them from like giving evidence against themselves or incriminating others or whatnot. You're basically saving them from that trap.
As much as possible, really the way I approach it, especially with the older kids, is look, your life is your life and your path is your path. And if you choose that path, I'm not judging you. But if you're going to be in the game, you better know the rules, and you got to have the courage to use them, right? You can't just be running around like robbing banks and you don't know the rules on how to rob a bank. You're like, that's a recipe for failure. So even if, you know, a kid's telling me like, this is who I am and this is what I do. Well, listen, where is talking to the police and getting yourself in trouble and giving them evidence? Where is that part of that? And they agree. They're like, well, no, that's not part. Well, yeah, you should know your rights then.
Yeah.
And then I get people who are wrongfully accused, and they should definitely know their rights, right? Because they're wrongfully accused. Like, you don't want this to turn into something worse than what it is. So it's best to be silent, because even when you're wrongfully accused, they're going to use it against you. So it's a really good program, I think, because I've had many parents thank me, and the police don't seem to like it, but it's the law, and police are supposed to follow the law. So hopefully they'll keep doing it. I will report that for a while, in the first year of existence, Seattle Police Department, they did an audit. They only called 1% of the time of their juvenile calls. That's changing. I'll give Seattle credit. That's changing. But Seattle Police Department, the first year that this law was in effect, they only called us like 1% of their juvenile cases.
That's not good, man. But I thank you, man, and our audience thanks you. I know you're doing a service to our people, man. I don't think people will ever fully grasp the depths of the plague of mass incarceration and how it can start from such an early age. You know what I mean? Like, these are children. They have actual studies and scientific proof that brains are not fully formed until age 26. You know,
look at our formerly incarcerated brother. That's a lawyer. He went in at 14. If we concluded wholeheartedly that he couldn't do anything with his life, then obviously we were wrong, because he's a lawyer now. You know, we can't close the door on, we certainly shouldn't, we shouldn't close the door on any human, but definitely not children. Children haven't had a chance, because like you said, their brains aren't formed and they haven't had an opportunity to show and prove yet. Give them that opportunity to show and prove. And most of them will prove you wrong.
Absolutely. It was amazing speaking with you, Arian Nolan. You're an inspiration. Honestly, I'm so grateful for what you've done for me, but for others as well. All right, Arian, have a great night, and thank you again for stopping by, and we want to bring you back.
Hey, thanks for having me. God bless you guys. Talk to you later. Right. Bye-bye.
Bye. Start the long and forgotten, threw away the key. Gone and forgotten, they forgot about me. Long and forgotten, threw away the key. Gone and forgotten, defund the OC. If I was you, I'd be asking for a refund. Everything they do for DOC, they need to defund. Lazy guards, double cells, everything in here is hell.
you ever been to the county jail, praying that you get some mail, then you hit receiving all the stories, can't believe them. I thank God that I'm alive, I thank God that I'm still breathing. After COVID, wearing masks, everyone's sad. How did a virus know a budget? It really makes me laugh. We had good times, bad times, but still it made us strong. It was hard to be accountable, I had to right my wrongs. But now I'm long and forgotten, they forgot about me.